Welcome, Hadavar students. Welcome to our next session in the First Regathering, Zionism and the Modern State of Israel. We're in session 11 as we look at the rise of Zionism. Let's do our customary review. Last session, we began with the split in the Haganah, the Irgun Zevi LaEmuni. Etzel was founded. In 1933, Hitler became the German Chancellor, and that began an anti-Jewish economic boycott in Germany. And the first concentration camps were set up, and so immigration from Germany ramped up. This led to the Fifth Aliyah, made up of a lot of German immigrants into Israel. 1935 was the 19th Zionist Congress, then the Nuremberg racial laws were passed. In 1936, the World Jewish Congress was founded. In 1936, the Arabs rioted and strike in Israel. This led to the 1937 Appeal Commission to examine the reasons for the riot and strike, and they proposed a partition of the land. And this was the Appeal Commission Partition Plan of 1937. The yellow area is the Jewish state in the coastal plain and the Galilee. The green area is the Arab state plus Transjordan. So most of the Arab state isn't even seen on this map. But anyway, the area called Palestine is now... In the green is now to be set aside as an Arab state, and then the red area is a mandated enclave. So what are we seeing here? Well, this is the original area allocated for the Jewish National Home in San Marino of 1920. This whole area is called Palestine. This whole area is the British mandate and the potential home for the Jewish people. However, in 1921 to 1923, Churchill divided up the British Mandate area into Palestine and Transjordan. Transjordan, to the east of the Jordan River, became under Arab influence, and Palestine, to the west of the Jordan River, was now a possible home for the Jewish people under Zionist influence. Now the Peel Partition Plan comes along, and the Peel Partition Plan is very willing to divide Palestine up once again, the Jewish state being limited to the coastal plain and the Galilee. So what are we viewing here? Here we're witnessing the shrinking Jewish state. Now what exactly is going on here? Well, what's going on here is Satan's attempt to shrink the Jewish state out of existence, and this is an attack on the land promise of the Abrahamic covenant. Remember, Satan is the prince of this world. He influences the governments of this world. And so he's hard at work influencing the governments of this world to shrink the Jewish state so it does not exist. If it does not exist, then the Abrahamic covenant cannot be fulfilled, and Satan's career is safe. This brings us to the 1937 20th Jewish Congress and the Arab Revolt. The Arab riots turn into a full-fledged revolt in 1937, and that leads to stockade and watchtower settlements. These were prefabricated settlements made beforehand and then rushed out to a plot of land and set up. This plot of land was an empty acreage in the morning, but in the evening it had a stockade and a watchtower, and a settlement had been completed. 1938, Wingate organizes his special Jewish units to fight Arab terrorism. This is one of Wingate's special night squads. Then the Woodhead Commission... The Woodhead Report from the Palestine Partition Commission brought their opinion as to how the land should be divided up. They had three options. First, Plan A was the Jewish state on the coastal plain and in the Galilee. So that's Plan A. But they also had Plan B. Plan B was the Jewish state in the coastal plain and in the eastern Galilee. Notice the red mandated enclave now takes up at least half of the Galilee. And they had Plan C, which was the Jewish state simply on the coastal plain. And the mandated area now takes up all of the Galilee. And so what are we watching? We had the Peel Partition Plan in 1937, but now the Woodhead Commission plan is willing to remove Galilee from the area of Zionist influence and limit the Jewish state simply to the coastal plain. So it continues. The shrinking Jewish state. That state would not have been a viable state, would have been easily conquered by the Arab countries in 1948. But we'll see about that. We'll come to that. All right, Kristallnacht, the economic ruin for the Jews in Germany, occurred. 1939, beginning of World War II and the London Roundtable Conference. The Arab delegations refused to sit with the Zionists, and so what devolved was two conferences. This was in the St. James Palace. It's also known as the St. James Conference. This is the Zionist delegation sitting in their meetings, and this is the Arab delegation sitting separately in their meetings. All right, this brings us now to the new material, and we come now to the McDonald White Paper. In May 17, 1939, London issued the McDonald White Paper. His Majesty's government had decided to establish a quota of 10,000 Jewish immigrants for each of the next 5 years, plus another 25,000 immigrants, for a total of 75,000. After a period of 5 years and 75,000 immigrants, no further Jewish immigration would be permitted without Arab permission. The sale of lands to the Jewish people was prohibited immediately. The declaration British policy was a foreclosure on any subsequent growth of the Jewish national home. It sealed off Palestine as a haven for all but an insignificant fraction of Jewish refugees, and this at the very moment when European Jewry was faced with a mortal threat to its continued physical existence. The Arab Higher Committee chose, for tactical reasons, to denounce the White Paper. You know, too much immigration. And the Zionist response was clear-cut, too little immigration. Now, on May 18th, the day after the White Paper was issued, the Jews of Palestine conducted demonstrations throughout the country, furiously denouncing the White Paper in synagogues and in public meetings. And here is the McDonald White Paper. This is the cover of that document. And here's one of the protest demonstrations. This is taking place in Jerusalem. And this may be the same demonstration. This is in Jerusalem as well. And here's a demonstration that took place in Tel Aviv. You can see the demonstrators on the upper right corner of the picture there, and the police to maintain order down across the middle of the street there. So isolated riots broke out, and one policeman was killed. The revisionist paramilitary organization, the Irgun, Zavai, Le'umi, the Etzel, bombed a number of government buildings in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and sabotaged rail lines. In Britain itself, the White Paper met with serious criticism on all sides. No criticism was as harsh as Churchill's. He said, "This pledge of a home of refugees, of an asylum, was not made to the Jews of Palestine, but to the Jews outside Palestine, to that vast, unhappy mass of scattered, persecuted, wandering Jews whose intense, unchanging, unconquerable desire has been for a national home. This is the pledge which was given, and that is the pledge which we are now asked to break." Thank you, Mr. Churchill. When the Palestine issue reached a vote in the House of Commons, at the end of the month, the cabinet won a slight majority. It was a bare 268 votes cast in approval out of a total of 413. 179 voted against the White Paper, with an unprecedented 110 abstentions. So the Chamberlain government's stringently anti-Zionist interpretation of the mandate required the approval not only of Parliament, however, but it also required the approval of the Permanent Mandates Commission. The members of the commission did not accept the argument. In their report to the League Council, they declared, "The policy set out in the White Paper was not in accordance with the interpretation which, in agreement with the mandatory power and the council, the commission had placed upon the Palestine mandate." So vindication by the world body was of little consolation. At this time, Zionist resistance began to take shape. The Jewish Agency publicly sanctioned and privately organized clandestine immigration. The influx of illegal refugees became unusually heavy in the spring of 1939. Agricultural settlements continued to go up under the cover of darkness. The agency ordered a secret Haganah registration of all men and women between the ages of 18 and 35. So for Britain, the White Paper of 1939 appeared to pay off. A major part of the oil resources of the Commonwealth were in the Arab world. So the MacDonald White Paper, by and large, succeeded in keeping the Arab world quiet, and that was its rationale. However, for the Jews, the White Paper of 1939 was a likely death warrant for their people in Europe and conceivably for their hopes in Palestine. The United Jewish Appeal is now founded. Fundraising was no means an experimental venture for the American Jewish community in 1939. Jewish federations had been operating in American cities for decades. Although earlier in the century, they were oriented primarily to local and a few national Jewish communal needs. Then, during World War I and the rest of the war years, or I should say the post-war years, welfare funds were devoted increasingly to such overseas needs as the National Refugee Service, the Joint Distribution Committee, and finally, the United Palestine Appeal. And here is a poster for the United Palestine Appeal. Later, too, as the Nazi horror began to unfold in the 1930s, the decision was to integrate these campaigns of these overseas philanthropies into a single fundraising organization, bring them all together under a single head, and this was not known henceforth as the United Jewish Appeal. Henry Montour was appointed the first executive director of the newly funded United Jewish Appeal in 1939. However, the United Jewish Appeal became more than just a fundraising organization. Over the years, the UJA has become an important educational factor in American Jewish affairs. Through its widening program of institutes, lectures, and workshops, the UJA brought before the Jewish public information regarding Jewish history and contemporary life. And the United Jewish Appeal is functioning primarily through the Jewish federations throughout the country. It builds Jewish identity in the diaspora. All right, next, the Lochamei Herut Yisrael Lehi is founded. Beyond the control of the Jewish agency itself, there emerged a number of activist splinter groups, limited in number, but fanatical in purpose, that were unwilling any longer to accept Zionist discipline at a time when Jews were being exterminated in Europe and the British were barring the doors to Palestine to survivors. So the technique adopted by these militants was violence. The most ungovernable faction in the emergent underground movement was the Fighters for the Freedom of Israel, simply known as Lehi for its Hebrew initials. And there's a logo of Lehi, the flag of the Lehi movement. Consisting of barely 300 members, the Lehi was one of a handful of Jewish paramilitary organizations that sprang up during or immediately following the Arab insurrection of 1936 to 1939. The founder was Avraham Stern. His guerrilla group was commonly known as the Stern Gang. Avraham Stern was a Polish-born Jew in his early 30s, a teacher, a dabbler in poetry. He briefly studied classics at the University of Florence. He had been decisively influenced there by what he saw of fascist tactics and Mussolini's intense fear of England. He was soon convinced that British presence in the Middle East was harmful to the future development of a Jewish national home. He came to the conclusion that all emphasis should be placed on anti-British rebellion. No other Jewish underground group was willing to go that far, not even Etzel at this time. After the outbreak of World War II, Stern moved even further to the right. Desperate for money, Stern and Lehi soon were reduced to occasional bank robberies. In January 1942, a Sternist bomb attempt meant for British intelligence officer instead killed two Jewish police inspectors. A few weeks later, Stern was shot dead by the police. Far from ending Lehi's militancy, these events seemed to impel its remaining members to acts of even greater desperation. Their hatred of the British transcended reason or control. 1941, the Palmach is organized. As World War II progressed, the British suffered stunning defeats in North Africa at the hands of the German tank commander Erwin Rommel. Throughout the long and painful ordeal of retreat, Britain derived very little encouragement from its Arab treaty partners, the Arab allies to Britain. King Farouk of Egypt communicated admiration and support for Hitler. Iraq was intensely anti-British. No courtship of the Axis was more avid, however, than the one carried out by the Mufti in Jerusalem. And here's Hitler and Haj Amin al-Husseini having a private little meeting. So al-Husseini inspected German troops and hobnobbed with German soldiers. Although sorely tried, the British were not entirely without local support in the Middle East. The Jews proved loyal. We were loyal because we faced the common enemy. Now, the Jewish agency mobilized the Yishuv's resources for wartime agricultural and industrial purposes. In the first month of the war, the Va'ad Le'umi, the National Council, announced the registration of volunteers for national service. 136,000 men and women enrolled. Their motivation was not simply an understandable desire for battle against the Nazis, but the expectation that an armed and active Jewish force would obligate Britain to reconsider the Zionist case. Additionally, military skills acquired during the war could be put to good use later. It was the Jewish agency's hope to organize their troops into a separate force under its own flag, something akin to the Zionist Mule Corps of World War I. From the outset, the idea was opposed by the British military and civilian officials in the Middle East. General Sir Evelyn Baker, the British Army commander in Palestine, warned London that the establishment of a Jewish fighting unit in the region would provoke a renewed Arab uprising, and Britain sure didn't want that. In the spring of 1940, Winston Churchill assumed the prime ministry. Now, Churchill was intrigued by the idea of arming Palestine Jewry, if only to release British troops for duty on other fronts. The decision was postponed by Churchill, and by the time anything came of the Jewish army concept, the war in the Middle East was over. However, when the military situation turned against Britain, senior Haganah officers were invited to collaborate with British in preparing lists of bridges and tunnels that were vulnerable to sabotage in Lebanon, Syria, Turkey, and Iran. And other joint efforts followed. In the early spring of 1941, Rommel's Panzer Army launched its operations in the Western Desert, and Nazi infiltration of Syria became more overt. So Haganah cooperation was urgently needed. The need soon became evident for a permanently mobilized Jewish task force. And such a unit accordingly was established by the Haganah in May of 1941 and classified as the Palmach, the Plugot Machatz, the strike companies. And here's the Palmach logo. One of its purposes was the defense of the Yishuv against Arab bandits that would inevitably harass Jewish towns and settlements the moment the British retreated from Palestine. More importantly, if and when Axis armies entered the country, the Palmach would be employed to attack the enemy wherever possible, to disrupt his communications, sabotage his transport and airfields. Now, the commander of this new elite force, not surprisingly, was Yitzhak Sadeh. Yitzhak Sadeh. In the 1930s, the veteran night fighter immediately set about recruiting the Haganah's ablest young men, mainly from the kibbutzim. On the eve of the Allied invasion of Syria, June 8, 1941, Palmach volunteers were needed for a final reconnaissance of Vichy positions. Now, the Vichy was the French government that collaborated with the Nazis. So Sadeh chose two companies for the task. Their officers were the commander's favorites, Moshe Dayan and Yigdal Alon. And here we have a picture of the three of them together. Here is Moshe Dayan. In the center is Yitzhak Sadeh and then Yigdal Alon. Now, the troops were divided into 12 squads. Two of these units guided the advancing Australians. Others cut wires, ambushed Vichy patrols guarding bridges over the Litani River, blew up culverts, and sabotaged roads. In the attack on Iskander, Moshe Dayan showed exceptional bravery, capturing 12 Vichy troops. Later, in exchange of fire, he lost an eye. And this is the Moshe Dayan we're so familiar with his eye patch covering his missing eye. In July of 1942, Rommel's forces were hurled back at Al Alamein near Egypt, and 4 months later driven out of Libya altogether by a reorganized Eighth Army under the command of Lieutenant General Bernard Montgomery. Once the danger to Palestine ebbed, then in autumn of 1942, the British closed the various Palmach training bases. The British, in turn, relegated the Haganah to its former illegal status. Refusing dissolution, however, the Jewish Defense Force simply became underground once again. Indeed, its members had swelled to 21,000 men and women. The Palmach also remained intact in various scattered kibbutzim, training secretly, even organizing a clandestine naval program and developing a rudimentary air arm under the facade of a tiny aviation club. And here's a picture of that first flight course, 10 students in 1937, the beginning of the Israeli Air Force, this tiny, quote, aviation club. By then, having worked deeply with the British, the Haganah and Palmach leadership understood better the ways in which a European regular army functioned and what its strengths and limitations were. Now we move to 1942. There are massacres in occupied Russia. The death camps of Auschwitz, Majdanek, and Treblinka begin to function at full capacity. And in fact, in 1995, this revelation regarding the Holocaust came forth. It was in a publication by the World Jewish Congress, Dateline World Jewry, in June 1995. And this is how it read. The British Broadcasting Company, that'd be the BBC, may have underreported the Holocaust because of fear of upsetting the Arab world, according to a recently aired program on the BBC. Frank Roberts, a wartime Foreign Office official, reveals in an interview that we, quote, "We wanted to keep the Middle East quiet. We had to be careful we didn't give the Arabs the impression we'd suddenly turned into a pro-Jewish, pro-Zionist organization." So that was quite a negative view, negative help in World War II. All right, now we come to the sinking of the Struma in the Black Sea with 769 refugees. In 1942, an incident occurred which became in the Yishuv the very symbol of Britain's unrelenting wartime policy against the refugees. On December 16, 1941, the the SS Struma entered the harbor of Istanbul and dropped anchor. Excuse me again. It was an unseaworthy vessel of about 180 tons. It was both steam and sail powered. Several weeks before, it had departed the Romanian port of Constanta and limped along the Black Sea with Palestine as its goal. Now here we can see a map of the area. You can see the Black Sea at the top of your slide, and there down at the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea is Palestine. And the only way from the Black Sea into the Sea of Marmara, into the Adriatic Sea, and into the Mediterranean to get to Palestine is through the Dardanelles, which is located in this small spit of land. Here is Constanta, and here's the Bosphorus, the Bosphorus, not the Dardanelles, the Bosphorus on this small spit of land joining Europe and Asia. Actually not joining Europe and Asia, there's a break there. So the Struma sailed down the coast, and here is Istanbul and the Bosphorus. You can see actually the two continents are separated by a very tiny body of water there. Black Sea in the north, the Sea of Marmara to the south. And here's a view looking south on a kind of a hazy day, looking at the Sea of Marmara off in the distance, and the Bosphorus winding its way up toward the photographer. All right, well, the Struma sailed down the coast and reached the Bosphorus and turned down and docked in Istanbul, where they were now quarantined. The Struma had its engine malfunctioning, and its hull was leaking, and so it was forced to anchor there for repairs. The ship was packed with 769 refugees, and they were planning a voyage across the high seas. Unable to proceed further, the Jews implored the Turkish government for sanctuary. Their appeal was turned down. Barred from going forward and unwilling to return, the Struma passengers remained in Istanbul harbor for 2 months, suffering from hunger, overcrowding, and mounting panic. The Jewish agency employed the British to allow the refugees entrance into Palestine, if only for transshipment to another destination outside of Palestine, and that suggested destination was Mauritius. Well, where in the world is Mauritius? Well, it's this little tiny speck of land in the Indian Ocean, located there, Mauritius. But the mandatory government refused. Let them stay where they are. Well, eventually, on February 24, 1942, the Turks ordered the Struma towed out of the harbor. So the quarantine was lifted, but they were not allowed to proceed any further. They were towed out of the harbor. 5 miles beyond the coastline, the ship took on water and sank with the loss of 428 men, 269 women, and 70 children. Recent reports indicate that it was torpedoed by a Russian submarine. The horrified reaction of Palestine Jewry was at least partially echoed in other Allied countries. Even in Britain, the tragedy was angrily debated in the House of Commons. 1944. Etzel and Lehi strike at the British. After 1942, the Lehi, under its new leaders, Nathan Friedman Yellen, and here's Nathan or Natan Friedman Yellen, or also known as Natan Yellen Moore, and Dr. Israel Scheib, or as also known as Israel Eldad, concluded that violence was the one method capable of driving the British from Palestine. And they were wanted men. Here's a Palestine Police Force wanted poster. We're going to look at this corner of the poster. And that corner of the poster, what do we find? We find Nathan Friedman Yellen. And who's next to him? A man who will become well known in Israel, Yitzhak Shamir. So they extorted funds from Jewish shopkeepers, and Lehi soon engaged in indiscriminate shootings of British police. Not infrequently, the Lehi members were themselves shot down in gun battles. The attacks mounted in intensity, and so did British retaliation, with mass arrests, curfews, and the imposition of the death penalty on those carrying weapons. Still, the underground campaign went on, and once included an unsuccessful murder attempt on the High Commissioner Sir Harold McMichael on August 8, 1944. So here is Sir Harold McMichael. He narrowly escaped assassination. 3 months later, the Lehi perpetrated its most audacious crime. It took place in Cairo, of all places, and was directed against Lord Moyne, the British minister resident. So here is a picture of Lord Moyne. On November 6, 1944, two Stern Gang members shot Moyne fatally as he was leaving the British residence. And here is a picture of the Lord Moyne funeral. The youths were placed on trial in Cairo on December 10, 1945, and were swiftly convicted and hanged. With few exceptions, the Zionist community was horror-stricken by Moyne's assassination. Ben-Gurion issued a passionate plea to the Yishuv to cast out all members of this underground gang and deny them shelter and assistance. Thereupon, the Haganah launched a full-scale attack against the Etzel and the Lehi both, denouncing them to the British police. But the damage to the Zionist cause was already far-reaching. Jewish goodwill had come to an end, and British patience was now similarly exhausted. We now come to the Jewish Brigade being organized and fighting in Italy. Upon the invasion of Italy in the autumn of 1943, the front line shifted north from the Arab countries. It was much simpler matter by then to justify Zionist participation in the struggle for Europe, because millions of Jews were being exterminated by the enemy. On July 12, 1944, Churchill sent a memorandum of the war, to the war secretary, instructing him to begin organizing a Jewish army group. In October, the War Office appointed Brigadier General Ernest Benjamin as commanding officer of the brigade. And here is General Benjamin inspecting the Jewish Brigade in 1944. And the Jewish Brigade on display. And here's the Jewish Brigade in action in Italy. They did go to Italy and served well. And this young man is holding a shell. And the Hebrew says, a present for Hitler, a present for Hitler. A Zionist banner was approved together with a blue and white shoulder patch inscribed with the Shield of David. So this is the insignia of the Jewish Brigade. A recruiting and training program was launched, and early in 1945, 3,400 Palestine members of the brigade were shipped off for combat duty in Italy, where they were attached to the British 8 Army. As it turned out, this Jewish fighting force represented an important political accomplishment of Zionism during the war. Equipped with its own staff services and artillery support, it became the training ground where hundreds of Jewish officers and NCOs first mastered logistics, organization, and tactics on a brigade scale. The experience added to the Haganah reservoir of trained fighting men in the event of a post-war struggle against the British or perhaps with the Arabs. 1945, World War II comes to its conclusion. Now, at this point, I would like to take a few minutes to explain the significance of the Holocaust. Here, remember the Abrahamic Covenant, with its three pre-promises, its land promise, a nation promise, and a spiritual blessing promise. The Holocaust is an attack on the nation promise, the seed promise of the Abrahamic Covenant. It is an attempt to destroy the people itself. Remember, the land promise was attacked as Satan tried to squeeze the territory for the Jewish national home out of existence. But now Satan is trying to destroy the Jewish people themselves, because the Jewish people are a leg of the Abrahamic Covenant. The Jewish people make up the nation promise. And so this is the background to all anti-Semitism. If Satan can destroy the land promise and the land covenant, if he can destroy the nation promise and its expanded development in the Davidic covenant, then the Abrahamic covenant cannot be fulfilled, and Satan's career is safe. So that, remember, is the key reason behind anti-Semitism. There's all kinds of reasons put forward on the surface level, but you have to get down to the spiritual level to really see what's going on. And this is what's truly going on. Satan is trying to save his career, his own skin. And why? Because God has this covenant with the Jewish people. He can't attack God, so he'll attack the apple of God's eye. All right, at this point I'm going to show you four famous pictures from the Holocaust. I'm not intending to shock anyone with these pictures. These are not the worst pictures available, believe me. But if you're Jewish, you grow up with this stuff. You know, here is a picture, a very well-known picture, of Jewish killings in Ivangorod, the Kiev, gunning down Jewish families in cold blood. And of course, the Warsaw Ghetto. These Jewish people are being taken out of the Warsaw Ghetto for the death camps. A very famous picture, especially with that little boy in the foreground. And I think you'll be happy to know that the little boy survived. Somehow, he survived the Holocaust, and his story is written by Don Parat in the book The Boy, which is available on Amazon.com. This is a Holocaust story that you might be very interested in reading. here are the survivors of the Ebensee concentration camp. They were liberated in 1945, and you can see these men are nothing but walking skeletons. And finally, here's a photograph of the Buchenwald concentration camp when it was liberated by the Allies, and a very well-known Jewish refugee is in the picture. There's a picture. There's Elie Wiesel. He's peeking out from behind that post and from behind his friend. Elie Wiesel went on to write Night, about the Holocaust. I believe he received a Nobel Peace Prize for this book. Another book worth reading, a movie worth seeing is Schindler's List. Now, Schindler's List is done very realistically and very graphically, so it is not a pleasant movie to watch, but it is a worthwhile movie to watch, telling you about the activities of Oskar Schindler as he saved the lives of many Jewish people. Again, not a pleasant movie to watch, but one that you should watch so you'll know exactly how the Nazis operated and the Holocaust and their brutality. Another book worth reading is Survival in Auschwitz by Primo Levi. And this will be a good time to view the program Against All Odds, Israel Survives, program number 4, The Miracle of Survival, Hitler and the Holocaust. This program 4 goes into that detail. So if you want to understand the Jewish community today, you have to understand the Holocaust, the Shoah. And this program only goes about 27 minutes, so it's very well worth watching. Now, let me take another digression and reiterate the importance of World War I, and then bring into the picture the importance of World War II. How did these two wars affect Zionism and the modern state of Israel? Well, we learn the first reason in Matthew 24, verse 3, and verses 7 and 8, when Yeshua is on the Mount of Olives and the disciples bring to him three questions. We read in Matthew 24, 3, as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, his disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things happen, number one, and what will be the sign of your coming, number two, and the end of the age. What will be the sign of the end of the age? Three questions are asked. Yeshua answers the question regarding the end of the age in verses 7 and 8. Yeshua says, for nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. In various places there will be famines and earthquakes. But all these things are merely the beginning of the birth pangs. So nation against nation and kingdom against kingdom are Jewish phrases, Jewish figures of speech during the first century for a world war. And birth pang is a biblical figure of speech, yes, a picture for the end days. So the answer to the third question, when you see a world war, that is the sign of the end of the age. So World War I marked the beginning of the birth pangs, the beginning of the end of the age. So we've been in the last days, the end of the age, since 1914. Now, if you want more details about this particular understanding of eschatology, I would highly recommend another book, the book Footsteps of the Messiah by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum, available from Ariel Ministries, also available on Amazon.com. I believe this is the best book on eschatology and the book of Revelation and the sequence of prophetic events that has been published to date, so I recommend it very highly. A very, very significant book. All right, let's get back to the importance of World War I and II. So World War I is important because it marked the beginning of the end of the age. So we're in the end of the age, and World War II also provided the opportunity for the Jewish national home. The Ottomans had been thrown out of the Middle East, and the League of Nations has approved the mandate and has approved the formation, the reinstitution of the Jewish national home. So the opportunity for a Jewish national home is there through the League of Nations, through the British mandate. World War II, however, dramatized the need for the Jewish national home, because one-third of the worldwide Jewish community was destroyed during World War II due to anti-Semitism. And so this it became very apparent that there was a need for a Jewish national home. The Jewish people fleeing from anti-Semites needed a place to go. In 1945, World War II came to an end, and we come to Bevin's Declaration on Israel. Following the end of World War II, Europe was teeming with displaced persons. President Truman paid special attention to the plight of the Jewish refugee and directed that no Eastern European Jew be turned away from refugee camps in Germany. Therefore, refugee traffic from the East to German relocation camps gained momentum. By the summer of 1945, nearly 100,000 Jewish DPs had reached Germany. One family was the Fruchtenbaum family with young Arnold Fruchtenbaum. And this is a recent picture of Dr. Fruchtenbaum. He became eventually the founder and director of Ariel Ministries. He is the author of the book Footsteps of the Messiah that I recommended just a few minutes ago. This can be purchased from Ariel Ministries or from Amazon.com. Again, the best book on eschatology and revelation that I have run across. I recommend it very, very highly. So I'd recommend that you purchase this book and study it. He also began, Ariel Ministries has also begun a website. This is their website, ariel.org, and you can avail yourself of more Ariel Ministries resources by going to the Ariel website. Now, on the Ariel website, you'll learn more about Arnold's testimony. Arnold Fruchtenbaum was born in 1943 in Siberia, Russia, after his Jewish father, falsely accused of being a Nazi spy when he fled Poland from Hitler, was released from a communist prison. And so Russia is divided by the Ural Mountains into two halves, Western Russia and Siberia. Now here's another map of Western Russia and Siberia, but this time we can see the district of Tyumen Oblast. Now let's move in and take a close look at Tyumen Oblast. In this district, there's the city of Tobolsk, also known as Tubal in Ezekiel 38:2. This is Arnold's birthplace. He was born in Tubal in Tobolsk, Siberia. This is Tobolsk in 1913. His testimony continues. With the help of the Israeli underground in 1947, the Fruchtenbaum family escaped from behind the Iron Curtain to Germany, where they were confined to British displaced person camps. There we are. They've now come to the DP camps. There, Arnold received Orthodox Jewish training from his father before the family finally immigrated to New York in 1951. Before their release, however, the family was befriended by a Lutheran minister, and it was this contact that eventually led Arnold and his mother to the New York headquarters of the American Board of Missions to the Jews, known then as ABMJ. And 5 years later, the same meeting brought Arnold at age 13 to a saving knowledge of Jesus the Messiah. So that's how Dr. Fruchtenbaum came to know the Lord. All right, let's move back to our time with Britain and the Labour Party. At the same time, the Labour Party in Britain had won a stunning victory. This is, of course, the end of World War II. And the Clement Attlee government came to power. So hopes in the Yishuv revived dramatically. British workers will understand our aims, Ben-Gurion declared exultantly upon hearing the news. The community that now demanded recognition was no longer a precarious minority settlement. By 1944, the Jewish population of Palestine had reached 560,000. Its economy had been profoundly stimulated by the war. Almost half of its food needs could now be supplied by its own farms. Industrial production had risen dramatically. Ben-Gurion led a deputation to London within 109 days after the Labour Party's accession to power. He carried with him a request for the immediate admittance into Palestine of 100,000 Jewish displaced persons. On August 25, 1945, the Colonial Office replied with a very, very exceedingly generous offer. They said, well, we can't give you 100,000 immigrant certificates, but we'll give you 2,000 of them. They're left over from the original white paper allotment. You can have those. And we'll also give you a supplementary quota of 1,400 refugees per month, provided the Arabs agree. So this response dumbfounded and appalled the Zionist leadership. By then, a guideline for the Middle East already had been prepared by the Labor Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin. Here's Bevin. It accepted as unchallengeable the importance of maintaining the friendship with the Arab world. One reason was economic. In 1945, Britain was bankrupt. One of Bevin's priority concerns during the grim post-war years was to assure the security of the single most important of Britain's remaining overseas resources, and that was oil. Oil was the power source of the country's very industrial existence and a foreign currency earner of near sacred importance. Britain's vast holdings were concentrated in the Middle East, partly in Iran, but largely too in the large and the vast Kirkuk field in Iraq, in Kuwait, and in Qatar. The need for oil and oil pipeline easements was one factor in determining Bevin's Middle East policy. Geopolitical strategy was another. The Soviet Union was emerging as a potentially far more serious threat to Britain's military and economic dominance in the Middle East. So Bevin appreciated with acute urgency that Britain's sphere of influence in the Persian Gulf area, with its immense oil reserves, and in the lower Middle East, fronting on the warm waters of the Mediterranean, had to be protected at any cost. Now, he wasn't unfamiliar with the Palestine question. At the time of the second Labour government under Ramsay MacDonald, when the Zionists were denouncing the Passfield White Paper, representatives of the Histadrut had called on Bevin as a fellow trade unionist to help, and he gave help willingly. His intercession with the MacDonald government had played a decisive role in safeguarding the Zionist cause. But now, 15 years later, Bevin was unwilling as foreign secretary to thrust himself into the Palestine question without a detailed additional study. In the United States, by early 1945, the State Department had moved firmly to a position of anti-Zionism. Our State Department was absolutely opposed to the Jewish national home. Undersecretary Joseph Grew warned the Roosevelt administration that Zionist activities in this country will remain the gravest threat to friendly relations between the United States and the countries in the Near East until a solution to the problem is reached. Let me back up again here. For the previous 2 years, a series of research studies on Palestine had been conducted by the State Department Interdivisional Committee. In their summary of January 1945, the committee members urged that Palestine be stipulated an international territory under the United Nations trusteeship. Now, President Franklin D. Roosevelt was vague on the issue. Roosevelt assured Ibn Saud of Saudi Arabia that he would not adopt a hostile stance to the Arabs, and that Washington would not alter its basic approach toward Palestine, quote, without full and prior consultation with both Jews and Arabs. And, of course, here is the king of Saudi Arabia, Ibn Saud. So not to worry, sir, we're not going to make any radical changes in the Middle East. Roosevelt subsequently remarked that on account of the Arab situation, nothing could be done in Palestine. Now, David K. Niles, he was the political advisor to the White House, was probably correct when he once remarked, quote, there is a serious doubt in my mind that Israel would have come into being if Roosevelt had lived. Roosevelt died in April 1945 of a massive stroke, and suddenly the way was clear for a Jewish national home. Now, Harry Truman's approach was less equivocal. He had been a pro-Zionist from his early manhood. So Truman sent Churchill a brief note on July 24, 1945, expressing hope that the British government would take steps to lift the restrictions of the White Paper into Palestine, and that the Prime Minister would let him have his ideas on the settlement of Palestine question so we can later discuss the problem in concrete terms. So Harry Truman basically said, let's have another look at this Palestine question. Before a reply could be sent, Churchill was defeated in the general election. Soon afterward, Truman dispatched Earl G. Harrison to study the conditions of the Jewish displaced persons. And here's Earl G. Harrison. Harrison's report not only indicted American military insensitivity, but also laid out a number of uncompromising proposals for solving the refugee question. And here is the Harrison report. With thinly veiled indignation, Harrison described the appalling circumstances of the death camp survivors, their despair, their frantic anxiety to leave the European morgue. At least 100,000 of them, the report suggested, ought to be evacuated immediately, and Palestine is definitely and preeminently the first choice. Truman endorsed the proposal without qualification. He went for the whole Megillah. In a letter to Prime Minister Attlee on August 31st of 1945, the president urged that 100,000 Jews be allowed into Palestine forthwith. The appeal took Attlee by surprise, so much so that it required 2.5 weeks until Bevin and the Foreign Office could prepare a response. The reply offered a clue to London's emerging approach to the Palestine question. It rejected the notion that Jewish displaced persons had suffered more than non-Jewish victims of Nazism, and it rejected the plea to allow 100,000 into the Holy Land. There's little doubt that the British government made a serious error in their refusal to accept the 100,000. But it would have been useful if Bevin had exercised verbal restraint, and rather than warn on November 2, 1945, that if the Jews, with all their sufferings, want to get too much at the head of the queue, you have the danger of another anti-Semitic reaction through it all. In other words, don't you dare use your suffering as an excuse to get to the head of the line. That was his response. This remark elicited a day of mourning in the Yishuv. And therefore, illegal immigration intensified. Even before World War II, the Zionist leadership had sponsored illegal immigration of Jews from Europe and from the Middle East, known as Aliyah Beit, Immigration Plan B. Immigration Plan B was simply a euphemism for non-official or illegal immigration. From the inception of this program in 1930, from its inception in 1938, the director was Shaul Avigdor. When the war ended, Avigdor returned to Europe to open a new office, this time in Paris. His instructions from the Jewish agency were clear and unequivocal. They were to organize the immediate departure of Jewish DPs for Palestine. Nor was this to be a clandestine smuggling effort of just a few hundred or even a few thousand refugees. What was intended, rather, was traffic organized on a scale far-reaching proportions, involving tens of thousands of Jewish refugees. The homelessness of these victims of Nazism was to be fully exploited, even ruthlessly, to dramatize the fate of the Jewish people and the callousness of the British immigration policy on Palestine. By autumn of 1945, the first groups of several hundred refugees were taken out of their camps in the American zone of Germany. In trucks supplied by the Jewish Brigade, they were carried to French and later Austrian borders. And you can learn more about the Jewish Brigade with this DVD in our hands, available on Amazon.com. And that's another bit of history that you'd be well worth being familiar with, the story of the Jewish Brigade. The refugees then made their way over mountain passes by foot, and were transported afterward to French and Italian coasts and these waiting Haganah ships. Now, the largest number of Haganah vessels were Italian coastal ships of pre-war vintage. These were obsolescent ships, but they were fitted out for a Mediterranean crossing. Many thought it was unthinkable to load them with hundreds of passengers. Nevertheless, they were hastily repaired in various Italian shipyards and were sent to their embarkation rendezvous, usually in secluded inlets near large Adriatic ports. The initial sailings caught the British by surprise. Half a dozen ships slipped by the British Coastal Watch into Palestine during the late autumn and early winter of 1945 and 46, unloading some 4,000 refugees. And as we move on, we come to the cooperation between the Haganah and the Etzel. In 1945, the Zionist leadership had rightly concluded that if Britain's attitude was based on Arab strength, then Britain must be equally impressed by Jewish strength. And for the first time, the agency approved specific measures of physical resistance. Thus, in November 1945, the commanders of the Haganah and the two dissident Jewish underground forces reached an agreement that all future Etzel and Lehi operations would be coordinated under Haganah direction. And for the next 8 months, the three groups undertook systematic attacks on British installations. During the latter part of 1945 and early 1946, Etzel and Lehi embarked on a number of daring and successful raids against British armories. In October 1945, a joint Haganah-Etzel operation dynamited the British rail network at 200 different points throughout the country, effectively paralyzing British troop movements. And here's a picture of some of that railway sabotage. The Haganah also destroyed three British naval launches that had been intercepting refugee vessels. Other acts of sabotage were carried out against British airfields, radar stations, and coastal lighthouses. Military reinforcements were promptly set in by the British. The government's retaliatory measures became increasingly severe, and yet underground agents were rarely caught. General Barker, the commanding officer in Palestine, had to admit later that the Jews knew all government secrets and military plans within a day of our making a decision. Their intelligence system was uncanny. The attacks continued, hitting police, army, and naval garrisons. The British were confounded. Until the post-war period, they had been accustomed to thinking of violence in Palestine as exclusively an Arab phenomenon. But the force and savagery of Jewish resistance came as a shock to them. No longer were the Jews passive. We were now characterized by active insurrection. Nevertheless, Bevin's determination to solve the refugee issue and the future of Palestine in his own way was not easily undermined. And I see we've come to the end of our time, so we'll pick this up next session with the Anglo-American Committee publishing its conclusions in 1946. So we'll see you then. Join us for our next session. Thanks for being our students. Lehi Tra'ot. Lehi Tra'ot.